So I'm going to talk to you about my book, sort of give you an overview of the history of the Muslim community in Detroit. So increasingly today, Islam is viewed in the U.S. through the lens of anxiety. Muslims are said to be anti-democratic, misogynistic, intolerant, and unfit for citizenship in our society. My project is not about those things. It's about something else. My project is about the anxiety that Muslims themselves have felt, right, about their presence here, about the challenges they faced establishing a community here in the United States. And I'm going to begin this with a newspaper story that appeared in the first Muslim American publication called The Muslim World. This was published in 1922 from Detroit, Michigan, actually technically from Highland Park, Michigan. So I'm just going to read you sort of the first paragraph so you can get a sense of what this very different kind of anxiety in the Muslim community is about. So it was written by a man named Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, and I'll tell you a bit more about him in a minute. But he says, there are many Mohammedans in this country who come from Syria, Palestine, Albania, Serbia, Bosnia, Turkey, Kurdistan, and India. Their exact number is yet unknown, but they are in the thousands. This epistle is addressed to all of them. I beg to be excused to say that in the majority of cases, you are Muslims in name only, Islam not playing a practical part in your everyday life. Nay, even your names are generally no more Muslim because you have adopted American names. These are the days of trouble for you. The Muslims are being disturbed and dispersed everywhere. The United States is a very good country for you to live in. I wish millions of Muslims to come over here, settle in this land, make it their home, and enjoy the privileges of citizenship in this free, fertile, and rich land. But I must advise you. And then he has these 10 points here. Keep and preserve your faith wherever you go. Keep your faith always above the world. Retain your Muslim names. Say your 5 daily prayers, right? This is a kind of a familiar list. If you imagine yourself going to a country where whatever faith you practice is a minority faith, right? You're a new immigrant, you've got all these things you're struggling with. This is a very familiar list. The one that is really sort of most important to me in my work is this one, number 8. Build a mosque in every town to worship one God, however small and simple it be, but there must be one. Right, so this was written by Mufti Sadiq. One second, I'm out of sequence my orders. But there's an idea that's contained in this list, right? Remember, it was written already in 1922, right? But you can see that he's feeling anxiety about America, the fact that people are changing their names. He doesn't see them sort of practicing their faith or putting their faith in front of them in the way he would like to see. And what I found is when I look at the historical record, right, when I look at newspaper stories, at artifacts from mosques and other religious institutions, even sometimes when I interviewed elderly Muslim Americans, this trope of loss, right, is ever present. It's present in texts like this one that was written in 1922. It's present in the sermons that were given by new imams who came to the country in the 1940s. And really, you can hear it today in Detroit's mosques. Right? So when people talk about the pastor, when historians have gone back and looked at these documents, right, they've taken Mufti Sadiq's text and said, wow, look, all the Muslims changed their names. Right? They've taken it as evidence of sort of a reality on the ground instead of as an exhortation being offered by a religious leader. Right? So that when people talk about the past, these are the sort of tropes that I hear echoing through their conversations. So in the first place, there's this decision or this way of describing the early Muslim communities as not having been really religious, right? Not religious in the way we are today, whatever period the comment is being made. Not religious enough. That their mosques aren't really mosques. Their mosques are social clubs. They provide some other function, but they're not really mosques. That the community is not engaged politically. In fact, that if it had been engaged politically, all the problems of the Middle East wouldn't have happened. So these small minority of Muslims had it in their hands to save the world. That the community was divided and isolated, that these different pockets of the community, the Palestinians, the Syrians, the Albanians, the African Americans, they didn't really know each other. They weren't connected to one another. And then finally, and this sort of goes against the other ones, this idea that the Sunni Shi'i divisions were not common in the past, and that they were always brought about by new people. When this new guy came from the old country, he divided us. That's kind of the trope I heard in my interviews with people. So that is sort of goes against the others because, of course, it implies that the community, it actually fits into the pattern because it shows it's part of this, they weren't really religious, right? If they'd been religious, if they'd known the importance of these divisions, they would have maintained them. So it's a little bit more positive than the others, but it's there for a reason. So what I did was I started going back and looking at what was actually happening in Detroit, right? And the patterns that we saw here in Detroit were not distinctive, right? Certainly we had a larger number and a greater diversity of Muslims here in the city, and that's why Detroit really is a leader in terms of the history of Islam in America. But there were Muslims in New York, there were Muslims in Chicago, there were Muslims in Cleveland and Toledo and Toronto and Cedar Rapids and all over the country, right? And so we see in this early period, by 1907, the first property was purchased in New York City for the purpose of establishing a mosque, the American Mohammedan Society. They renovated an apartment house and used it for a social hall and for a Sunday school and for a mosque. In 1914, we had a housing cooperative that opened in Highland Park, Michigan. The point of the housing cooperative was so that these Muslims, these newly arriving people from Turkey and India and Syria, could collaborate and purchase housing together. They could make sure that it was a male-only boarding house so that there wouldn't be prostitution or things like that in the house, and also so that they could observe no alcohol, no pork, that sort of thing in the dining hall facilities. In 1916, we had an Arabian American Society. This was the first Shi'i Muslim association in Michigan. It started in Highland Park. In 1916, the United Muslim Association was a confederation of Muslim associations from throughout the Midwest. How's that? As early as 1916. The Red Crescent Society was established in Detroit to try and provide to do many things, actually. Khayrat al-Umma is a similar organization that was started in Chicago, sort of bringing Detroit, Chicago together. So my point here, right, is that there was a lot happening in the teens, in the interwar period, the post-war period. And this is why. This is why people were coming here to Detroit, right? These are the gates. This is the Henry Ford's Highland Park factory, which started in 1914, sort of the turn from 1913 to 1914, started offering a $5 workday, which more than doubled the wages of the average worker at the time. Now, this drew a lot of people to Detroit. The city's population was doubling and doubling again in this period, as did Highland Park's. Incredible rapid urbanization was taking place around the city. But this was especially important for Muslim immigrants because a lot of these migrations were relatively new to the United States. They hadn't been, in the country for 60 years, for 100 years, like a lot of the Eastern European, Southern European groups that were here at the time. A lot of those migrations were like second or third migrations where people had settled somewhere along the coast and come here. These people from Turkey and Syria in particular came to Detroit as their first location of settlement. And I will tell you that this street right here that we see in the picture on the left, this was actually one of the avenues on which a lot of the early Syrians settled. There's an elderly imam who arrived in the country in 1912, and he describes getting off the streetcar. He had had a little pin stuck to his lapel, like a badge stuck to his lapel that said, that named all of the train routes, the train, where he was supposed to change trains, and he had his fare in his pocket for each leg of the journey to America. And the last one was this streetcar in Woodward Avenue that was supposed to let him out in the neighborhood. And when he got there, he got off the streetcar, and he said, "I heard Arabic, all Arabic. Everyone was speaking Arabic. They were all from my village. They were all from Bintij Bail." He was so happy he had arrived. So this was a very important migration for the Arab American community in this area, and in particular for the Muslim community. And I also just want to say one other thing. So about right here, if we're looking at this left picture, about right here, if you extend over from the picture, well, maybe more over here, that's where the first mosque in the United States was built. So here it is, the Muslim Mosque of Highland Park. It opened in 1921. It was a collaborative effort. A number of people in the community came together to build it. Here's a newspaper story. And you can see this building was actually built as a mosque. Right? It might not look like such a fancy mosque, but this was built from the ground up. So it was the first purpose-built mosque in the United States, with its, you know, sort of symbolic dome and its symbolic minarets. But nonetheless, a building that really belonged on the streetscape, right? It didn't stand out in any remarkable way. It looked like all the other buildings on the street, and it was pretty small. But here we see the three religious leaders who presided over the opening day services. So the one on the left is Khalil Bezzi. He's the man I described to you getting off the streetcar, coming here, not speaking any English. He's from Vintage Baal, which is a village in the south of today's Lebanon. He was the leader of the Shia community in Detroit. And in this period, really just like today, the Shia community among the Arabs, the Shia outnumbered the Sunni in this early period. It's still true in the metro area as a whole. The man on the right was Mohammed Karoub. He was also a Lebanese immigrant, sort of Lebanese-Syrian, and he had studied Islam at the Suleimaniya Mosque in Damascus, so he was sort of considered to be sort of a religious scholar by the standards of the day. He was a Sunni religious leader, and his brother actually is the person who financed the mosque and built it very specifically so he could lead the prayers in it. And the man in the middle is Mufti Sadiq. He's the missionary who wrote that the column that I read for you in the first slide. Mufti Sadiq was a part of the Ahmadiyya movement. So if you're familiar with Islam, you understand that the Ahmadiyya are a tradition that differ quite a bit. They diverge in their teachings from mainstream Islam because they promote the idea of this figure Ahmed, who was the last prophet, who came after the prophet Muhammad. Most Muslims, just like Christians, sort of our prophecy ends with Christ. The prophecy of Islam ends with Muhammad, right? So here's this new prophet that this community recognizes. So that was somewhat problematic for the other Muslims, but when he first got here, they didn't realize that that's what he was teaching. But anyway, he was part of this political movement in India. He was sent to the United States very specifically to missionize here, to try and convert Christians to Islam. He was offended because so many British colonial officers were trying very hard and giving all these rewards and benefits to British colonial subjects who converted to Christianity. And he said, if they're not going to stop this, I'm going to go over there and sort of turn the tables on them. So he came here. He came first to Detroit. He was invited here by the Karoub family once they read about him in the newspapers. So here's his a text from his opening sermon. This is the first Muslim mosque built in this land, and I'm proud to have the first prayer in it as the first imam. This mosque, although built for the followers of Islam, will be open to the believers of all religions for a place of rest, prayer, and meditation. Mohammedans believe in worshiping, but the one God, Muhammad, on whom be peace and the blessings of God, is a prophet of God. The religion of Islam treads underfoot all racial prejudices. And that's like a very important line. It was very important for him. He came to the United States on the ship on the way over here. He converted 17 people who were on the ship with him, and he was immediately imprisoned in New York because people said, "Oh, he's a Muslim. He's going to teach polygamy. He's going to promote polygamy in this country." And we had just sort of overcome our problems that we had with Utah gaining statehood over the issue of polygamy, right? So there was this sort of back and forth over, you know, Muslims and Mohammedans, Muslims being Mormons and Muslims being too similar to each other, right? So he made a point of saying, no, look, Islam teaches people that when you go to another country, the laws of that land, as long as they don't directly conflict with your religion, those are the laws you have to adhere to, right? So these are sort of two very important messages. But on the question of racial prejudice, right, Mufti Sadiq was the first person to realize how powerful Islam was as a tool at reaching not white Americans. Most Anglo-Americans weren't interested in Islam, but at reaching African Americans, right? And this notion of the faith as being a colorblind religion is something that you'll see it gains more and more significance over the decades. So he and the Karubs collaborated to produce this newspaper, the Muslim Sunrise. You can see Detroit isn't literally in the middle, but it's, you know, close enough to being in the middle. And this idea that, you know, this area really was at the center of this efflorescence of Islam, this new Islamic civilization that was being promoted in the United States. So another question that people ask is, why Detroit? Why was Detroit the first place to build mosques like this, right? If you had these Muslim communities, and I showed that there were Muslim associations forming in all these other places. Well, this picture is one of the keys to that. There's Khalil Bezzi right there leading the prayer. This is a funeral service. I love the funeral service because it's not what we think of as a traditional Islamic funeral service with the band there. The funeral, the cemetery provided the band usually. But you also see quite a few children, women and children in the picture. So most of those communities that were here in Detroit at the time, the Turks, the Bangladeshis, the Indians in particular, they were really bachelor populations. They were men who came here by themselves to work, send money home, for reasons having to do with the laws of their sending countries mostly. The Lebanese community was really the first community to come here as families. Right, especially by 1910, 1920, we saw more and more families coming here. And usually, if you talk to any new immigrant community in the United States, people start building churches, they start building temples and synagogues and other houses of worship quite specifically when they have kids here, when they have American-born children. Right, because one of the main purposes of these houses of worship is to provide for the religious education of the children and also to find marriage partners for them who were from the same religious background, right? So this picture is here because it really sort of illustrates that this was a community more than just a bachelor community. Now, the first mosque, as I mentioned, it had these three religious leaders who were from three very different religious traditions, and I'm not going to go into all the details of it, but it did not work out as a mosque, okay? It was a great tragedy, a great crisis. This is also why when I talk about sort of rediscovering the history, right, a lot of people didn't want to talk about some parts of this history because they were painful to them, and certainly the narrative of that first mosque is one of those painful narratives. This is the second mosque that opened. It opened in Detroit itself on Hastings Street in 1925. So does anybody know Hastings Street? What was Hastings Street known for?
One String Sam.
One String Sam. The blues, yeah. So why? Black Bottom, yeah. So this became really right in the cusp of this period. In the 1920s was when Black Bottom became the center of African-American life in the city. Or more, it had long been the center of African-American life in the city, but this is the point at which you really had a high population density when the population turned over from being a multi-ethnic, diverse population to being really specifically an African-American population, right? Because racial exclusion, you know, covenants and practices in other parts of the city, blacks could only live here. And as their population was growing in this period too, this is when the Great Migration was taking off, and you had a large-scale migration of African-Americans up to the north from the south. So Hastings Street was really right. It was the main commercial center of Black Bottom, but it was also sort of a borderline street between Black Bottom and these neighborhoods just to the east of there that were where most of these bachelor immigrant populations lived. And if you look in the early 20s, there were several Arab and Indian and Bangladeshi and Afghani coffee houses along Hastings Street, right? And this mosque was built in one of those coffee shops. And we can see here that it's got a different name, right? It's named the Universal Islamic Society. Right, so that might imply to us that they're trying to overcome some of the divisions that created tension at the first mosque. And that was indeed their main goal. The three sort of leaders of the organization were on the right, that's Khalil Bezzi again. On the left, this is a man named Duz Muhammad Ali. Duz Ali was a very important figure in the Pan-African movement. He was a Sudanese immigrant to England who wrote, in the period right before the First World War, he wrote a newspaper called the New Asia and Orient Review. It was published out of London. It was a very political, a very anti-colonial kind of newspaper that really promoted the history of India, the Middle East, and Africa as having one thing in common, right? Their experiences of colonization at the hands of basically the British and the French were the ones that they were most concerned about. And also this idea that the thing that would enable people from Africa and Asia and the Middle East to overthrow their colonial overlords was Islam. That was sort of the main message of his newspaper. Marcus Garvey interned with him in England before coming back to America and starting the UNIA, the United Negro Improvement Association. And in fact, Dues Ollie came to Detroit from New York, where he had been writing a column on Africa and on Islam for Marcus Garvey's newspaper. Okay, so he already had a reputation. So we had Khalil Bezzi, the Syrian. We had Dues Ollie, the African nationalist. And then the third person was this man right here, Shah al-Abedin, who was a South Asian immigrant. All right. So here we had universalism, not just in terms of religious sect, right, but in terms of these different national communities. This was a definitely very explicitly political religious association. So this was created in Highland Park. Now, it was created in Detroit. The thing that made it distinctive from Highland Park is that this really was just men, right? This mosque wasn't built in the heart of a community, right? This mosque, its focus was not on religious education of the children, like the Highland Park Mosque had been. Okay, so, and when the Depression hit Detroit, basically this population scattered. So this congregation was sort of pulled apart by the Depression. So, but it's not a matter of coincidence that this mosque was located 2.5 blocks away from what would become Allah's Temple of Islam, which was the first worship house, the first meeting space in which the Nation of Islam got organized. Right. So a lot of the people who worshipped at this mosque were sort of understanding, sort of focusing on this universalism of Islam. Oh, and there was a text I wanted to read to you, just to illustrate this point, so here is a witness, an eyewitness to that prayer that's in the picture just before this. I was invited to the meeting of the Islamic Association by two Indian Muslims who knew me from New York. Indeed, in the small group, there were individuals from various races and nationalities, including a blackest Negro from some remote part of Africa. He had been scarred on both cheeks according to some custom of his tribe. Contrasting with all the local white Christian churches, in which the Negroes were not permitted even to offer prayer, the small Islamic group of diverse races was a sort of illustration of Islamic unity. I was asked to speak to the group. I didn't know what to say. I said that various religions taught various ways for the salvation hereafter, though no one has returned to inform us about the other world. But in the present world, despite all sorts of beautiful teachings of all the other religions, it is only Islam that practices real fellowship among all the human beings. This proof is right here among yourselves. Right, so you can see that, in fact, there was this sort of understanding that Islam was something exceptional in this period. And Dues Ollie was certainly a very active promoter of this idea as he walked around the city and intermingled in the city. So I'm not, it's sort of outside the scope of my book. I don't really, I bring this Nation of Islam into being, and then I sort of skip over it until the 1970s when this community comes back into the fold of the Muslim communities. But they were clearly followed on the heels of Noble Drew Ollie, who also taught sort of black nationalism, to a certain extent, black separatism, and certainly borrowed a lot of religious tropes and themes from Islam and promoted the idea of Islam as being that universal African-based religion. Fard Muhammad was an acolyte of Noble Drew Ollie's, and he was also an acolyte of Marcus Garvey's, who came to Detroit and really sort of inspired Elijah Muhammad, who became the main prophet, the main political leader of the Nation of Islam community until his death in 1975. So their congregation got started right there on Hastings Street, just blocks away from where that Universal Islamic Society was. Now, for the immigrant community, the Depression created real havoc. One reason that the Highland Park Mosque also suffered, didn't really succeed, the first one that was built in 1921, was also because by 1921, what was Henry Ford doing in 1921, other than building cars in Highland Park? Yes. He was definitely doing that too, yeah. But if for more for the purposes here, he was building the Rouge plant in Dearborn, right? That started in, 1916, 1917. But by the 1920s, the Arab community, who were again the recently arriving people, right? They were still just arriving in Detroit. A lot of them just went to Dearborn. They didn't stop in Highland Park. They came to Dearborn and they built houses right in the shadow of the Rouge plant, which is still a very important Arab American community, sort of the core, the anchor, the origins of that whole Dearborn enclave that was so well known today. So this is a meeting that they had in the 1920s. It's a Syrian nationalist meeting. But these kinds of meetings were very common in the period. What happened is all those Syrians who came together, whether they were Sunni or Shia, and there were a lot of Turks who joined them. Turks also moved to this neighborhood. They started talking. The men would come here and meet at the Salina Elementary School, and they'd say, "We need a mosque. We need a mosque. We need a mosque." The Depression, again, made it very difficult for them. A lot of people went back to Syria in that period, tried to make a go of it there. But they came together. When people were sitting at these meetings, what they were hearing from their relatives in other parts of the country is that this mosque had opened, the one on the right, in Ross, North Dakota, 1929 or 1930, built by the same group of people, just their relatives out in North Dakota. The Cedar Rapids Mosque in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, opened in 1934. The Asr el-Jadid Temple in Michigan City, Indiana, opened in 1935, right? They were like, "Wait a minute, we had this mosque. We were the first. How come these other people are beating us to it?" So finally, once they started, once work returned and people had a little bit of money in their pockets again, by 1937, they started opening mosques in Dearborn. This is the first Dearborn mosque. It was called the Progressive Arabian Hashmi Society. It was founded in 1937. And just a few blocks away, we had the American Muslim Society, which was founded. These, why two mosques a few blocks away? Because people preferred to follow their own imam. The Shia wanted to worship behind Khalil Bazi, and the Sunni wanted to worship behind Muhammad Karub, right? It was just easier. We have Protestant and Catholic churches all over the landscape. This is a similar thing. The communities really supported each other. They helped each other in fundraisers. As one woman said to me, "We both ate the same mujaddara," which is, a peasant kind of dish that people eat. So this is what the building originally looked like. That's why this picture is here. The picture was taken in the 1950s, but it was just a kind of small... They called it the basement because it really kind of went underground. It was just a one-room building. Here's what it looks like from the inside. Does anybody recognize this person right here? Yeah, this is Orville Hubbard. If you know Orville Hubbard, is Dearborn's famous, infamous segregationist mayor. There's a lot of debate in the Arab community. He was certainly Arab, anti-Arab when it came to some things. But in his early days in particular, he wanted the Arab vote. Some people argue that he was actually more loyal to the community than hostile to it. But he loved raw kibbe. So apparently he would always show up for the mosque dinners to get the raw kibbe. So this is what their mosques look like, right? So you can imagine that if you're an immigrant, you arrive here, you'd see these things. These don't look necessarily like traditional mosques. Right? So some of that, the way people, newcomers see these institutions, you can see that their judgments were not entirely irrational. Also, what else is sort of distinctive about this picture? Anything else sort of stand out? The women, what about them? No hair coverings. Yes, this is what American Muslims looked like in the 1950s. Quite frankly, this is what a lot of people in the Middle East looked like in the 1950s too. The hijab was not the pervasive garment that it is today. Here they are having a fundraiser because they're about to add on to their mosque. This is the period that, if you look at these two mosques, here, this is the period when the Muslim community, especially as we got into the 1940s and the 1950s, when the community started to really grow again, not through immigration, but through birth, right? Second and third generation children were growing and, getting married and raising family. So the community started to grow, was doing a little bit better economically. And also, Arab Americans fought in World War I. World War II. They came home from the war. They wanted political representation. That was a very, very hot engine of assimilation, the war, when all these people from different parts of the country served together, and they found that they had a lot in common. People came home. They wanted to build mosques on main streets, not in ethnic ghettos. They wanted to build mosques on Michigan Avenue, on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. So they brought these imams from overseas to help lead them. The one on the right is Muhammad Jawad Shiri, and the one on the left is Imam Wahbi Ismail. Shiri is from Lebanon. Ismail is from Albania. I won't go, I'm looking at the clock and realizing I've got to really rush here. I won't go into the details of their politics, but both of these men, when they came here, they were horrified by what they saw. They also left books and texts. These were scholar imams, right? So they wrote all these books. Imam Shiri, he came to a mosque. He came to Hashemi Hall. This is kind of what it looked like, maybe just, again, just a little bit later than that. And the first thing he did when he got to Hashemi Hall was he bought a big rug, a big green rug, and he put it down on the floor of the mosque. The mosque had been open for about 13 years when he did this. He put the rug down on the floor, and he said, "I declare this a mosque." The supporters of Khalil Bazzi were not really very happy about this. The people who had been working all those years to build the mosque. He didn't speak English at the time. So his goal of preaching to the second generation was sort of an unrealistic one. He was immediately kicked out of town. He went to Michigan City, Indiana, where he learned English, where he kind of learned how mosques work in the United States. He learned that it was okay to have prayer on Sunday instead of on Friday because no one could come on Friday. He said when he came back to Michigan, he said the most important lesson he learned is that women run the mosque. Okay? So you can see quite a bit of Americanization going on here over the years. He also said he was going to open a school. That's why I have these pictures, to teach Islam in a school where kids were already learning Islam. This is the first mosque that Imam Wahbi opened in a former Armenian church. So this was the first Albanian mosque in the city. We also had in this period, Masjid al-Mu'mineen was created by an African-American veteran who had fought in World War II, also converted to Islam, went and studied overseas for several years, and when he came back to America, he wanted to open a mosque for his community. There was a population of, there were dozens of families at least who were Sunni Muslims in the African-American community, and they suffered incredible discrimination in a whole variety of ways. In particular, the police were watching them. So if they tried to pray, they would be harassed. So they used to sort of pray in secret. But the imam who got the group started basically decided, no, we're going to just open and be a mosque anyway. But you can see here in the language, right, that he's really trying to say, we are not connected with the black Muslims. That's the Nation of Islam, right? We're not connected with them. We're not connected with the Communist Party. We're not connected with the secret society. No, Islam, again, this notion of Islam is not prejudiced towards colors, races, national origins, right? So a great deal of continuity. This mosque was started in Virginia Park in Detroit. Here's what the American Muslim Society looked like in the 1950s after that dinner, right? The dinner is the before. Here's what they built. Right, so here they're building a building that is comfortably a mosque, looks, says to the public it's a mosque. It's still in this working class neighborhood. Here's what it looked like on the inside. This was sort of the universal mosque for all the city. So I mentioned that among the Arabs, the Shia outnumbered the Sunni. Among all the Muslims in Detroit, the Sunni were by far the majority. Right? So we can see here, this is a holiday prayer. We can see Albanians, we can see South Asians, we can see Turks, we can see Arabs all praying together. Right, so again, sort of in living up to this idea of Islam as a universal religion. And also in this period, we had national organizations that were created. The Federation of Islamic Associations of North America and Canada was, as I mentioned, there had been that Midwestern one in the 19-teens. Well, this was just went way beyond that. It was founded by veterans. Their goal was to bring the community together, again, so their kids could marry each other. They wanted to get the federal government to recognize Islam. If you'd fought in the war, your dog tags either said Protestant, Christian, Jew, or atheist. Those were the options for you. Right? So people wanted the government to recognize them so that their veterans or their what do you call people who die in a war? Pardon me? casualties could be buried. Martyrs might be a better word. Could be buried according to Islamic law, right? So that was one of their main agendas. And they were also very interested in Palestine. They were very upset by America's support in 1948. So here they come to Detroit in 1957 for their annual banquet. And I have this picture up here just so you can see how diverse the crowd was. People knew each other. People were involved in, you know, sort of this sort of going against all those narratives we talked about before. It was also this banquet that brought Imam Shiri back to Detroit. When he came back, he immediately set about raising money and building a new mosque. He built the one down here on the bottom right, the Islamic Center of America, which is on Joy Road in Detroit. Again, they finally made it to a major thoroughfare in the city. This lovely, big, modernist mosque was the center of their community until 2005, when this congregation built that new mosque on Ford Road, the big one that you see in the media all the time. Here is Imam Wahbi's mosque that he built. If you're a Detroiter, you're probably familiar from this. It's right off of 94. When you're driving around to the east side of the city, you see the minaret right off the highway, if you're wondering. That's the Albanian mosque. Here's the Islamic Center of America in 1962. Right, this is what it looked like inside. You can see that the women do cover their hair when they're praying, but they're not wearing full hijab. Here's a wedding in the mosque. I love it. They used to have a piano, a white piano, and the bride used to march down the aisle to the wedding march. might sound normal to most of you, but this is not what takes place in most mosque weddings today. Here's the mosque from Toledo, just to give you an idea again about how these mosques were the center of community life, right? They were ethnic institutions as well as being religious institutions. And here's Masjid al-Mumineen. They're hosting the Muslim Student Association in 1963. So again, we can see that for the African American community, this was, you know, their patterns were very similar to those of the other Muslim organizations. Now, it's interesting that I had the Muslim Student Association on this slide. In the late 1950s, early 1960s, the United States government really began changing our immigration laws. And the first thing we did in the 50s is we made it possible for elite members of other societies, societies where we really had a political interest in particular, to study at American universities. So this is the period where sort of the term brain drain really gets its origins, right? Where we started bringing in very well-educated people to study at our universities. And the University of Michigan and Wayne State Universities were two major universities that received some of these foreign students. This picture here is mostly foreign students coming to Masjid al-Mumineen for a Friday prayer, worshiping. So they created these very close alliances with one another. In 1965, the laws changed more officially and sort of opened the door to a new kind of immigration, immigration that was not limited to Europe, right? Our racial exclusion laws were now no longer going to be in place, and people could come from all over the world. So this led to this influx of a new kind of Muslim, and in particular, the Muslim Student Association, a lot of these intellectuals came to America, they studied at our universities, they really appreciated so many of our technological advances and things like this, but they were disturbed by a lot of things they saw, really by our public morality. And they went home and they wrote critiques of this. And this led to, if we think of the term Islamist, right, this sort of new political Islam, this idea of looking to Islam's roots to find the answers to contemporary political problems, like applying Islam in the present in a way that perhaps hadn't been being practiced by the majority of Muslims in the world. This took root in this period. And so these Muslims brought with them a new kind of Islam, really. And so a lot of what I'm arguing in my book is not just that that we've forgotten the history of Islam in Detroit because of all the newcomers who are constantly arriving, who are sort of judgmental. It's also because Islam itself really changed over the course of the, you know, this period between the 1960s and the 1980s, really ongoing, like any religious community. So the one big transition that took place was this new immigration, which suddenly made Detroit relevant in a new way. Because a lot of these new Muslims who came to the United States came to Michigan where they had relatives already. But another thing that happened a decade later in 1975 was that Elijah Muhammad died. So his movement across the country by this period had, the numbers are very unreliable from the Nation of Islam, but it at least had tens of thousands of members. Okay, very active, adamant, definitely black nationalist, separatist community that had a motto of doing for yourself, right? Taking care of your own problems, solving your own problems, looking within your own community. It was a movement of moral uplift, socioeconomic uplift. Okay, this is what Muhammad's Temple Number 1, which is at this point on Linwood Avenue in Detroit. This is what Muhammad's Temple Number 1 looked like in 1975 while Elijah Muhammad was still alive. So we see a man in uniform speaking from a podium. Men and women are sitting kind of separate from each other, but in the same space. Everyone's sitting on chairs. They're facing a lectern. Here they are a few months later. After Imam Elijah Muhammad died, his son, Warith Deen Muhammad, took over the movement and began this process of bringing that community into the fold of Sunni Islam, basically. And this imam here on the right, Mazen Alwan, became the first preacher at Temple Number 1, which became Masjid Wali Muhammad in this transition period. So here just you see people are sitting on the floor like people do in mosques. They're facing the Qibla, which means they're orienting themselves towards Mecca. We see among the young girls, they're starting to learn about hijab, wear hijab. So this was a major transition. And it was not an easy transition. So a lot of people who sort of represent that older community, just as the newcomers were judgmental about the American Muslims who they found here, a lot of the people who represented those older communities also equally resented the newcomers who were trying to impose new rules, new standards in the mosques. And this mosque in particular, the American Muslim Society, it's now the oldest mosque in Michigan. It's on Dix Avenue. It's still there. This mosque was basically the site of a takeover. New Yemeni and Palestinian workers who had come and moved into Dearborn in this time, just when a lot of the Lebanese families were sort of moving on to other places, they started worshiping in the mosque. They were influenced very much by the members of Masjid al-Mumineen and some of the missionaries who lived there with them. And they basically started arguing, you know, we want to pray on Friday. We want to have our Jummah prayer on Jummah. Jummah is the main congregational prayer of the Muslim community. It's their Sabbath, the Friday. Most American workers, you can't get off a Ford on Friday if you're on the assembly line, right? So it was more senior citizens or people who worked the night shift. And they also, the American mosques, very often, they would celebrate the holidays on the weekend. Kids couldn't get out of school, so they would just wait and have the holiday celebration on Saturday. Well, one Saturday, these new Yemeni and Palestinian workers came to the door of the mosque, and they banged on the door, and they had demanded that they be let in to pray. And the door was locked. The head of the mosque, you know, hadn't arranged for them to be there, so they broke the lock, and they went in, and they prayed anyway. Right? So this led to a takeover of the mosque. And the older congregation went on and built new mosques in other parts of town. But the new Yemeni congregation, the mosque has doubled and doubled again and doubled again in square footage. Now 3,000 people can pray there side by side on a Friday afternoon or on a holiday. So it's one of the more important, larger religious institutions in the city. Okay, so a lot of transitions have taken place. I don't have time to sort of cover everything. But I do want to just sort of say a few closing remarks. Okay, so here's what one imam who came to the United States in 1980 said when he first showed up at his mosque, which was one of the older Lebanese congregations. He said, "They looked and acted like Americans. It was hard for me to accept. I still thought of Americans as non-Muslims and of Muslims as living in America, but not really being American." Right? So this kind of gets to that anxiety I was talking about. "The pattern has repeated itself many times. And I am struck by these institutional forms and religious practices that has survived these coups and revivals, managing to reassert themselves as Muslim Americans work out the logistics of life in the United States. Like their predecessors, the newest immigrants and converts are coming to feel more at home in America today, not because the U.S. is a welcoming place. In the post-9/11 era, it would be impossible to make this argument, but because they are making America a more Muslim place by raising their families here, building mosques, and participating in the social and economic and political worlds around them. In doing so, they face cultural and institutional challenges similar to those faced by their predecessors. The response to these challenges are strikingly similar. Over time, this cycle of challenge and response has yielded new generation of American-born Muslims and Muslim-born Americans who don't share the earlier anxieties about a supposed incompatibility between Islam and American life. Comfortable within their own skin as Muslim Americans and increasingly adept at playing minoritized forms of identity politics, these new generations, whether they came of age in the 1930s or the 1990s, confront existential dilemmas unique to their own position in an unfolding and ever-shifting historical process. They must struggle to be recognized as authentic Muslims by Detroit's steady stream of new Muslim arrivals, and they must struggle to be seen as authentic Americans by a larger non-Muslim society. So in this book, what I've tried to show is that the history of Islam in the U.S. can be written without privileging alienation and anxiety, but instead situates these phenomena within encompassing processes of incorporation and exclusion. And this, I say, is the viable future of a forgotten past. So thank you. Any questions?
So I think that was a brilliant job of trying to bring all of this together. There's so much going on here, ongoing, the evolution of Islam in America. And I like the way you brought together the African-American Islamic experience and kind of tied that in with its instigation down on Hastings Street. I was just interested in the Moorish society, Ali Drew. Mm-hmm. That's still going on, isn't it?
It is. They still have a place in Detroit, too.
Right. And so that is... Could you just kind of summarize a little bit about what the Moorish Society thing
is? Well, so the Moorish Science Temple brings together quite a few different kinds of religious traditions, right? They have a text, it was called the Seven Circle Quran, the Quran that Noble Drew Ali created. He basically started off by giving people an alternative identity to their Negro identity that people were suffering from here in America, right? So he called people Moors. He gave them, you know, he actually wrote to the Moroccan embassy and tried to get citizenship papers for African Americans who were embracing this religious tradition, right? I mean, again, this is, I didn't talk about the Jim Crow and how horrible conditions were for African Americans in the turn of the last century. But what a lot of people wanted was just to escape from that label that they had on them that, you know, contributed to the very harsh economic and social conditions in which people lived. And he really offered them an alternative identity. Hey, look, you can be this other thing. You're not Negroes. You're Asiatics, he said. You're Moors. You're something different. And if you're these other things, then Americans have to respect you. And he had, you don't see it so much in this picture, but he had people wear clothing associated with Asia or the Middle East or his idea of those places. He borrowed really quite a bit from Mufti Sadiq. When people joined the Ahmadiyya movement, which started in the 20s too and started in 1921, he would not just give them, convert them to Islam and have them say the Shahada and there you're a Muslim. He would change their names. He would give them new Islamic names. He would give them clothing to wear so that they were signifying their Islamic identity in what they wore. And so people were not just embracing Islam or the Moorish Science Temple, they were also shedding an identity that was very painful. And there's the Nation of Islam continued that, right? But his Circle 7 Quran, it borrowed some things from the traditional Quran, but it had many different sources of, all these sort of philosophical texts and mystical texts were also incorporated in this. And the worship services were not traditional prayer services. They were more sort of self-help meetings, guides to better living kind of meetings. And the group is still around today. Most of their members eventually either joined the nation or became Muslims. A lot of the people who are members of the Moorish Science Temple today call themselves Muslims. And they, I haven't been to one of their services. Outsiders aren't allowed to their services, so I'm not sure exactly what goes on. But they consider themselves to be much closer to Islam than their ancestors were, back in the 20s and 30s. But again, I'm not really sure exactly what they're teaching. And a lot of young people who are raised in that community wind up worshiping at the Muslim Center in Detroit, which is sort of pulling that population away today. They're still there. They have a newspaper. I mean, militant is a hard word to use because I wouldn't say they're militant at all. They're very friendly. They just are serious about their belief system.
Yeah, that's what I meant. They're serious.
Yeah, they're serious.
Oh, sorry. The first mosque was Sunni Shia altogether in Ahmadiyya.
In the Ahmadiyya.
Ahmadiyya.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't last very long?
It didn't last long. So the reason the first mosque failed, it's really kind of complicated. So in the first place, people didn't really know how to finance the mosque. Okay? They didn't have a model for how are you going to do this, right? In the Middle East, you don't necessarily, you know, give a lot of money to your mosque. Your mosque is built by the government or it's built by a religious endowment. Right? So you go and you worship there, but you're not you don't hire the imam. You know, you don't have that much participation in your mosque. But here, they needed dollars. And so that was one issue, was just the whole organizational thing. It was very difficult for them. Secondly, the population was already moving to Dearborn. So that, you know, once they started having problems, people just sort of abandoned it. But yeah, the Sunni Shia thing was a problem. It was more that the Shia were the majority within the Arab community. And the Arabs built the mosque, so they wanted Khalil Bazi to lead the prayers. But the Karubs had built the mosque, so they weren't going to give up the floor. And also, as I said, the larger community was more Sunni. But the real problem was that this Ahmadi missionary had been invited here by the Karubs. And so people said that the fact that they had invited this person who represented this tradition that was not appreciated by the other communities, they basically said, see, he's not a real scholar. He's not educated. He didn't know any better. Therefore, we want Khalil Bezzi, right? So that's basically what happened. It was infighting. But once they got the mosques in Dearborn that were, you know, anchored by neighbors that were in a place where you had families, those mosques really thrived. And as I said, both of those institutions, I mean, now there are probably a dozen mosques in the Detroit area that grew out of these two mosques, and thousands of people who grew up in them from multiple generations. So these two mosques have been very, very important for the history of the city. They really anchored the new migration of Lebanese people who came during the Civil War. They anchored the migration of Yemeni migrants who came in the 1980s when their labor laws changed. They've just anchored one wave after another of new immigrants to the Detroit area, and that's still happening today.
Could black people live in Dearborn at that time?
No, they could not. And that's the interesting thing. I don't know if you noticed the picture I had of the mosque. Not only was Mayor Hubbard in it, but there were black people in it. and it's kind of ironic to me to see Hubbard eating a meal, because he would have been one of those people who wouldn't have wanted to break bread with African Americans. So, but at the mosque, he did. So when I talked about the black Sunni community in that early period and now they had problems worshiping in Detroit. But they didn't have problems. So a lot of them would come and worship in Dearborn. So there was sort of always historically, and today if you look at the history of that mosque, they have a large festival that they host of the Tablighi Jamaah community in America comes there and has a big festival in the summer every year. It's like thousands and thousands of African American Muslims who come and they camp out in Dearborn. It's a big festival. It's like an Arab African American alliance kind of mosque, maybe more than most of them are. But people couldn't live here, and you know, people tell me stories from the black community who kind of grew up attending this mosque or being close to it. They tell stories about, like, one day one young woman's father was asked to mow someone's lawn, and so this black man is mowing a lawn in Dearborn, and for a friend of his who was out of town, and all the neighbors came, and they called the firefighters came, and they tried to break down the door of the house. They were saying they'd heard that there was smoke, and they had to put out the fire. You know, there was just all hands were on deck to make sure that this black person didn't live in the house, and if he did, that he wouldn't want to live there another night. So this neighborhood, too, that the mosque was in, the South End neighborhood, is famous because it was It for a long time, it was listed in Ripley's, believe it or not, on the weekend paper. You know, they had those like little factoids that they would put in Ripley's every weekend. And this was the most diverse neighborhood in America. There were over 35 languages spoken in this neighborhood, right? But these were European languages. There were a few Mexicans in the neighborhood. There were a lot of white Southerners in the neighborhood. It was mostly Europeans. And the Syrians were, they fit in there. They weren't exceptional. most of the residents of the neighborhood were Christians. The kids talk about, you know, we would go to their church. If they were having an event, they would come to our mosque. If we were having an event, people would, you know, figure out where they were having dinner based on what people were, what's your mom cooking? What's your mom cooking? You know, so there wasn't this division in the community back in that period. And it's also the neighborhood, it's right by the Rouge plant, right? So this is where, you know, the Battle of the Bridge took place. This is where the Hunger March took place. A lot of labor activists. This is like the core, the UAW Local 600 is in this neighborhood, right? And an incredibly important neighborhood for that reason. And during World War II, the Arsenal of Democracy era, the state tried to build housing in the neighborhood for black workers because this is the era of the crisis in housing in Detroit. And you know, Hubbard was not alone. The city of Dearborn, all these neighborhood associations, block groups, you know, all these, the organized Dearborn and the mayor said no to this. And once that problem went away, the idea that public housing was Negro housing was the argument that was being made back then. Once the threat of that went away, the city quickly built temporary housing for white workers from the South. So, I mean, if you just want evidence that it really was racial segregation taking place, they rejected the one plan and then, you know, like a year later, built another thing. It wasn't the idea of public housing at all. If you have any questions, thank you very much for coming.